All right. So in your page there, you'll notice that it refers to McLean's triune model of the brain. That's because the person who came up with this theory was a guy by the name of Paul McLean. Now, Paul McLean was a researcher. He was not a body worker, not a medical professional. He's just a researcher, and his particular focus and interest was in the development of the human brain and the evolution of the human brain. And so this triune model of the brain, in its time, was considered a highly researched, evidence-based model of brain evolution over time that also mirrors brain development in us from utero into adulthood. Now, Paul McLean came up with this model in like the 1970s, so it's a little bit older right now. I will say that contemporary neuroscience has come a long way since this model and has updated this considerably. So the McLean's triune model of the brain would not be considered evidence supported any longer because we know so much more about how the brain works and how it evolves and develops from childhood into adulthood. However, it's an attractive model. Even if it's not kind of like biologically accurate completely, it's a model that tends to have a lot of intuitive rightness for us. It tends to speak to us. And so I like to still talk about the model because I think it can help us think about how the brain interacts with itself, even if the actual workings of the brain are more complicated than that. So what I'd like to do for today is to actually present the model in its classical form, the way that Paul McLean worked with it. And then tomorrow, if we got a little bit of time, or today, we can talk a little bit about how the model has been updated and about how they tend to talk about it. Because even in contemporary trauma circles, they still talk about the triune model of the brain. They just talk about a slightly updated version. Okay, so now, back to Paul McLean's original model. It's called the triune model of the brain, tri meaning three. And what the model essentially says is that over time, our brains have evolved in three large stages. And that also mirrors our own brain development from childhood through adulthood, arguing that we evolve in kind of three large stages. Those three stages are known as the R complex, the M complex, and the neocortex. The R complex would basically be considered like the reptilian brain, that part of our brain that we share with all of our reptilian friends. Whereas the M complex would be the mammalian brain, or that portions of our brain that we share with all of our mammalian friends. And then the neocortex would be what makes us a little bit more uniquely human. So that R complex would basically be that the spinal cord, the brain stem, and the cerebellum, that core neural chassis that really deals with basic life functions. The M complex, the mammalian brain, tends to deal more with emotionality, and then the neocortex tends to deal a bit more with like abstract intellectual thought. So the model basically says that when we were a really primitive species, we had a brain that did everything it needed to do, and it worked fine for us. Then after a while, we became a more complex species, and eventually we needed a brain that did more stuff. And so nature, in her infinite wisdom, rather than scrap the old brain and give us a new one, basically had us keep the original brain and kind of build a patch on top of it, or build a new brain on top of it that does the new stuff. You can kind of think of it like a brain upgrade, brain version 2.0 rather than brain version 1.0. And so then the argument is we kind of operated on brain version 2.0 for a really long period of time until eventually we became a little bit more complex of a species once again. And once again, we needed a brain that did more stuff. And once again, nature had us keep the original two parts and evolve a cap on top that does the new stuff. And so that's kind of like brain version 3.0. So Paul McLean's triune model of the brain is saying that we're all operating off of brain version 3.0. And as you'll learn in our lecture, brain version 3.0 is a highly buggy system that frequently crashes. And we kind of have to work with it. The analogy for brain version 3.0 is each of those three parts of the brain tends to speak like a really different language. and they don't really communicate all that well with each other. That's part of the problem. Imagine that we took a really tiny broom closet and crammed in there a person that speaks only Chinese, a person that speaks only Arabic, and a person that speaks only English, crammed them into a little closet, and then asked them to make life and death decisions. And so that's kind of like what we have going in our head, a little committee of three people speaking radically different languages, tasked with keeping you alive and running you. Okay, so let's dive into it a little bit more. Let me go through the whole lecture. I'll do some questions at the end. So beginning with the R complex, the part of our brain that we share with our reptilian friends, structurally, we're starting to talk about that core neural chassis, like I said. That would be the brain stem, that'd be the spinal cord, and that would be our cerebellum. And think about those brain structures and what they do for us. They tend to control our basic life functions. They're tasked with keeping us alive. This is where a lot of our natural impulses are, a lot of our reflexes. The core basic parts of ourselves are in the R complex. Think about how a lizard or how a reptile behaves, and you start getting a sense of what our R complex does. It deals with basic life functions, breathing, eating, pooping, eliminating, stuff like that. Also, this part of our brain is tasked with keeping us with survival and keeping us alive. So that would be the fight or flight response. Now, we don't, at the reptilian level, we don't really have an emotional experience yet. We don't have that rich emotionality that we're familiar with. The argument would be that lizards and reptiles don't really have emotions the same way they do. What they have is more like primitive impulses or motivations. So the primitive impulses would be fear and aggression, the things that go along with fight or flight. Now take a moment and think about how fear in your experiences of fear and aggression and how they live in your body. And you can kind of feel that fear and aggression live in your body in a very different way than like love or joy or empathy or the higher emotions. And if you think about fear and aggression, they are extremely powerful. I mean, when you're triggered and you're rageful, that's a tremendous power inside of you that's moving you around the world, basically to keep you safe or to escape. Now, also at the reptilian level, there is learning that happens. So there can be territory and territorialism. That lizard isn't born with its territory. It discovers its territory through its regular repetitive movements. So that lizard isn't born with its favorite rock. It just discovers its favorite rock in the process of living. It stays up there on that favorite rock doing its little lizard dance. And it's trying, and communication is happening at the reptilian level, and it's a communication that is based on fear and aggression. You know, communication that's basically saying to all the other little boy lizards, stay away from my rock, and trying to communicate to all the little girl lizards, I've got the best rock in town. Come check it out. And so that's where procreation happens. And you can, and we quickly see in human experience and other animals' experience, you can see how quickly territorialism and procreation tend to get linked up with each other. And then, like I said, learning does happen at this level. It's just more of a learning based on movement and based on habit. So rather than learning, I call it habit. Some animals, you know, work highly off of this type of learning, basically spinal cord learning. Like a chicken, for example. You cut a chicken's head off, the body can still run around until it bleeds out. That's an animal that tends to rely heavily on spinal cord learning. The way that that might operate inside of us, it would be like all your gestures and all your habits, the way you move. I mean, you could be a football field away just walking across and your friends are going to know it's you just by how you walk. Those types of gestures and habits, that would be kind of like a spinal cord learning sort of process. Or like how you shower. Chances are good that you shower pretty much the same way every time. You go through the same sequence. And your brain can just wander around and do whatever it wants to do while your body goes through all the motions to get itself clean. You know, your brain can take the time and think about every argument and what you should have said instead. I like to call the shower the hypothetical argument simulator for just that reason. Or sometimes people drive. by this kind of learning. If you've ever had the experience of driving somewhere and arriving at your destination and you can't remember a single part of that drive, you probably just drove there operating entirely off of patterned habit with very little cognition happening throughout the process. All right, so that's our complex type learning. Oh, other places where it lives. If you've been a musician and you memorize a piece, let's say that you've memorized a piano piece and you want to play it, you know you just sat down and let your hands do the work. And if you've ever memorized a piece, you know that the worst possible thing you can do is to try to think about what note comes next, because everything crashes because you just interrupted the spinal cord process with a cognitive process, and our cognitive processing can't handle that kind of information. But what it does do is the movements are handled at the spinal cord level, and that frees up our higher intellectual processes to do things like infuse the music with meaning, phrasing, stuff that kind of begins more of a communication process. Okay. So then we get a little bit more complex, and now we move on to the M complex. While you're copying this down, think about how mammals behave and how mammals behave differently from reptiles. And now you start painting a little picture of what the M complex does. This is not meant to be an exhaustive list of structures, but just more of a sampling. And I chose this sample because it's at the M complex that we start having a rich emotional experience. And I chose this selection of structures because this is also where we tend to have communication between our electrical controlling bodies and our chemical controlling bodies. And there are some researchers out there, most notably Candace Pert, that really argues that our emotional experience is largely our chemical body, our neurotransmitters, our hormones, and so forth. It's at the M complex and with these structures that you tend to have direct communication between the chemical body and the electrical body. All right, so now you've already thought about how mammals behave differently from reptiles, and now we can go through them. The mother-child bond, that's something that begins to happen at the mammalian level that doesn't happen at the reptilian level. If you think about it, a reptilian strategy of survival is basically playing the odds. You know, you've seen those National Geographic videos where mama turtle crawls up onto the beach, digs a hole, lays 100 eggs, covers them up with sand, and then she's toast. She's gone. You know, her job is done. And after a number of months, the cute little baby turtles climb out of the sand, they aim for the horizon, and the birds are picking them off, and they get into the water, and the big fish are gobbling them up, and one or two little turtles make it, and you're like, yay, go turtle. Hey there. And so from a reptilian point of view, that's survival of the species. That's totally successful. Couple of them make it. Great. The ones that don't, yeah, that's all right. And also, reptile babies are fully cooked. They're little miniature versions of the adults. All they have to do is stay alive long enough to get bigger and to be a fully functioning adult. All that changes when we get to mammals, because when mama mammal gets pregnant, it's actually a live birth. And so for a period of time, mama's resources are actually going to nurturing little one, which makes her more vulnerable and makes her weaker. So there's greater need for protection and greater need for resources given to mama mammal for that period of time. And then when mammal babies are born, they're not fully cooked. There's an even longer period of time where both of them need protection for nursing and resources given to them. And there's a longer period of time where baby mammal needs training on how to be a successful adult, training on how to hunt, training on how to play, training on how to do the skills of that particular species. On paper, there is a lot more resources devoted to each and every mammal baby than there is to each and every reptile baby. On paper, it almost doesn't make sense to have that much resources going to just the development of one creature versus playing the odds. So from a coldly biological process, I can't come up with a better argument for the sheer power of love, particularly motherly love, than making that huge devotion of resources worth it, not even something you question, something that we just do automatically, especially for something that's going to hate you at the age of 16 and rebel and think you're stupid and everything else. Part of this, you begin to realize that in order for live birth to happen, you have to be warm-blooded. You have to have a metabolism. And I wanted you to appreciate what a huge step in evolution it is to go from cold-bloodedness to metabolism and warm-bloodedness. And so as you begin to realize that you need that sort of, you need that metabolism in order to have live birth. You also need that metabolism and you need that emotional experience to have other creatures of your species protect you, hunt for you, and provide resources to you. It's at this layer that we start having a rich emotional experience and what we begin referring to as emotional intelligence. So your dogs and your cats are intelligent. It's just not an intelligence based on abstraction or projection into the future. It's an intelligence based on emotionality and navigating the emotional environment. The way we would talk about it in psychology would be manipulating the emotions. Now, I know manipulating to regular ears, that sounds bad. The way we're using it is more like navigating the environment. So when your dog, like let's say you've had a really rough day at work and you come and lay down on the couch, you're like, ugh. And your dog's over there smacking its food bowl around repeatedly until eventually you pull yourself up and toss some food in the food bowl. And then the dog looks at you, wags its tail and is really cute. That dog is actually showing a tremendous amount of emotional intelligence at getting its needs met and not getting shoved outside. That's what we mean by more like emotional manipulation. It's really understanding your emotional experience, understanding its own emotional experience, and changing its behavior to modulate it in order to be part of the pack and in order to be successful. So that's emotional intelligence. It's at this point that we actually start having community and pack behavior. The dogs that work together to hunt and to provide resources to the mama wolf or the mama animal that needs the protection. Like when that omega wolf decides, I would rather eat last and be part of the pack. So this is also where we start having subjugation of needs. So when that omega wolf decides, I'd rather eat last and be part of the pack than be alone and eat first, that omega wolf is showing a tremendous amount of subjugation of needs for the sake of being part of community and for the sake of being part of the pack. Now, it's not totally selfless because the pack can hunt better than an individual can, but there's still a subjugation of needs happening right there, which would also be emotionally intelligent behavior. And this is also where you start having play really appear, because play is essentially a way to train adult-like behavior. This is how you hunt, this is how you kill stuff, you know, this is how you gut it from the inside or whatever else. And so I kind of want you to appreciate what a big step in evolution this is right now, because in order for live birth to happen, you have to have a metabolism which requires protection and resource giving from a pack, which requires a social structure and emotional intelligence. And it's in here that you begin to realize that emotions become the glue that allow community to happen. Emotions become the glue that allow a pack to exist. Because a reptilian strategy of survival is basically a narcissistic one. Me, 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 me. I'm hungry, I eat, I'm afraid, I run, I'm angry, I fight, I'm horny, I procreate. Whereas by the time we get to a mammal, it's a really complex emotional world and dynamics that are at play. All right, so now we get a little bit more complex as a species. We get a cap that does all the new stuff on it. Now we're talking about the lobes, the wrinkly stuff, the neocortex. And these are the parts of our brain that tend to make us a bit more uniquely human. So this is where we would start seeing higher intellectual function. Things like psychologist means by personality. Like, yes, your dogs and your cats have personality. When we talk about personality, we're more talking about like a stable pattern of behaviors and responses that are acquired in the first few years of life that basically become the template that we carry around with us for the rest of life as a way to interact with new stimuli, new situations. And then higher intellectual function, this is more like the abstract intelligence, you know, concept of zero. What is truth? What is morality? What is right? What is wrong? Projection into the future. If I do this, this likely sequence of events will likely, you know, lead to this. And so things that get closely linked into that would be inhibition. Because a big part of your personality is what you learn what not to do with your impulses and desires. Abstraction, I already covered that one, like concept of zero, morality. All right. So those are the three parts of the brain. Now let's start putting some pieces together. And then now you can see what I mean by a committee of three people speaking different languages. Part of the problem is the neocortex is the youngest of the three. And the neocortex honestly thinks it's the only one that matters. It thinks it's the only one that matters because it's the only one that thinks. And yet we have these two other portions of the brain, the M complex and the R complex, that are much older, very powerful, and more than capable of taking over the entire body when they need to. To some extent, you can, well, let's do this. It's humorous, but it's worth the time. If you ever want to watch the three parts of your brain in action, just go drinking. Because alcohol is a nervous system depressant, it starts depressing the nervous system. From your body's point of view, it wants to preserve the important things first, or, you know, preserve the important things and let the less important things go, which is like neocortex. So let's say you walk into a bar at the beginning of the night. You don't have any alcohol in your system yet. You have intact inhibition, and you can think in terms of abstraction. You know, concept of zero, 2 + 2, what is right, what is wrong. A few drinks later, your neocortex ends up getting suppressed and the person begins operating primarily from their mammalian brain or their M complex. That's the point at which someone becomes highly emotional. I love you, man. This is the best class I've ever taught. I love it so much. Yeah. And if you've ever watched somebody in their mammalian brain, they're like a cork on the sea of their emotions. They're all over the map. They're angry, they're sad, they're jealous, they're confused, they're anxious. All the things are happening at once. And the important thing to remember whenever you're watching someone be mammalian or whenever you're mammalian yourself is the alcohol doesn't create the emotionality. It's only suppressing the inhibition of them. There is an awful lot of good scientific neuroscience research out there demonstrating that honestly, we are highly emotional creatures 100% of the time. It's just not particularly functional for us to get along with each other. So instead we have this neocortex up above it that takes the volume knob on our emotions and turns it down to a manageable level so you can put gas in your car and buy groceries and have normal conversations with people. So when the alcohol hits and the person's in their M complex, you're actually kind of seeing what's going on more typically. Now let's say you keep drinking. At some point, your M complex gets suppressed and a person begins operating primarily from their R complex. That's the point at which they become belligerent, aggressive, territorial. Hey, that's my bar stool, get off of it. I'm take you outside, let's go beat you up. You know, you looking at my man? You looking at my woman? Let's take it outside. It's also when somebody gets really looped into basic life functions, like detoxification. Gotta pee, gotta pee, gotta pee, gotta pee. Blah. Detoxification. And the person also becomes looped into their habits. You know, watching somebody in their R complex, they're still doing all the behaviors they normally do. They're just like caricatures of themselves. They're like gross approximations of themselves, but still doing all the same things that they normally do. You know? Sorry. Anyway. Cracking my own self up. Okay, and then if somebody were to keep on, and then highly procreative as well. You know, 2 a.m., they turn the lights on and you got all the little lizards out there dancing. Check out my rock, it's the best one in town, you know, and gain in a highly procreative mood. And then if somebody were to keep on drinking, at some point the R complex actually gets suppressed and it just knocks you out to like, you're an idiot, you're gonna kill us, we're just gonna sleep it off and focus on detoxification, you know, outgassing in every other way. And if somebody were to drink so much alcohol that they have a fatal amount of alcohol, they basically die because their brain is so drunk it forgets to breathe. The very last things that get suppressed are those respiratory centers. All right, so that kind of paints the picture of those three parts of the brain. And so to some extent, you can begin to realize within this model, you can start to think of different pathologies as existing at different layers of the brain. So a problem of the neocortex would be like a logic error. You're just not putting things together in the right way, you're not thinking it through, or your inhibition isn't really kicking in the way it's supposed to. Kind of like problems of your executive control functions. Or information errors, you just don't have the information you need. That would be more of like a problem of the neocortex. A problem of the M complex would be an emotional-based problem, and that would be like any of those run-of-the-mill emotional triggers that we all have. When you get triggered, it's kind of your M complex taking over the show and running the whole process. So any situation that could arise that would make you reactive and defensive is an example of your M complex taking over. For most North Americans, if you want to discover your emotional triggers, just go home for the holidays. For most North Americans, when you're sitting around that table with your family of origin and mom asks you to pass the salt, you know, anybody else on the planet asks you to pass the salt and you do something that kind of looks like that. But something about the way mom asks you to pass the salt, in a really short period of time, you're triggered and you're like, I'm a big kid now, let me lead my life the way I want to, this is bullshit, and then you're out of there. You know, BS, sorry, excuse me. And that's what I mean by like M complex is taking over. Likewise, you can also start to think of disorders of the R complex. Disorders of the R complex would be any situation where your very survival was threatened, whether real or perceived. So a trauma response or kind of a disorder of habit. A disorder of habit for me would be like an obsession, a compulsion, or an addiction. So when that little stimulus comes in, just reminds you a little too much of a situation where you're really terrified and overwhelmed. That's kind of your R complex, like, okay, we need to fight or flight. We're going to take over the whole show until I feel like you're safe, and then the other parts can come back online. Now, disorders of habit, like if you've ever talked to somebody who truly has an obsession, let's start with obsession, you know that there's no logic that can talk them out of it. There's no amount of evidence, there's no amount of logic that's going to convince them otherwise. That would be more of an obsessive kind of process. That's the R complex so focused that the neocortex can't interrupt it. A compulsion, you know, we're kind of looped into a behavior and you can't interrupt the behavior. I remember I worked with a man for a while who professionally was a wedding photographer, and his particular compulsion was constantly checking the lighting. And he could sit there across from me and in great anguish say, all I want to do is take a frickin' picture, and know for a fact that he was about to lose his entire career because he couldn't take a picture, but yet he was still unable to interrupt that looping of constantly checking that lighting over and over again. And then addictions. I mean, if you've spent any time around an addict, you really quickly learn that it's not a rational and not a cognitive process. Like, you can't go to somebody and just be like, hey man, stop drinking. I mean, the reality is they know that drinking's bad for them. They know it's destroying their friendships and their family. They know it's destroying their body. They know everything. But yet they're unable to interrupt that need to basically fulfill the addiction. That's kind of a looped-in R complex. And it doesn't have to be substance related. I mean, gambling, process addictions like a gambling addiction, it's the same thing. You know, or you could find somebody that stopped smoking 50 years ago, but with a little bit of verbal prompting, they're going to be able to reproduce all the behaviors and habits related to smoking. And if you wire up their brain is still firing as if it's actually really happening. I remember when I learned that, it gave me a lot of compassion for addictions, because you can't talk someone out of it. It is not a cognitive or rational process. That's part of what makes it so hard to treat. It's that kind of R complex looping on itself. And so what this starts to suggest now is, from a mind-body point of view, we begin to realize that kind of what we're trying to do is we're trying to help the three parts of the body talk to each other, or the three parts of the brain talk to each other, because they're not very good at it. So in the case of like an M complex problem, like an emotional trigger, it might look like understanding the emotional trigger so thoroughly and all of its kind of sequelae and responses that the next time that stimulus comes in, your whole brain has a chance to come up with a solution rather than just the solution of the M complex, which is emotional reactivity and defensiveness. In the case of an R complex trigger, it can look like understanding the trauma so thoroughly and feeling all the attendant emotions related to that trauma in such a detailed way that there's a hope that the next time that stimulus comes in, the whole brain has a chance to come up with a solution rather than only the solution of the R complex. And this isn't just Eric Moya making this stuff up. There is a lot of wonderful neuroscience research out there, particularly the research geared around mindfulness and meditation, really demonstrating, like the Dan Siegel stuff, demonstrating that any experience that integrates the three parts of the brain is conducive to kind of whole brain functioning sort of process. So now, things that can contribute to whole brain function. This is where I began making the argument that about the immense power of touch. My belief is that touch is capable of, safe therapeutic non-sexual touch has the ability to provide the type of safety that the R complex needs to be able to downregulate. Emotional reassurance in touch is capable of providing, safe sexual non-therapeutic touch can provide the type of emotional reassurance that the M complex needs to downregulate. And now the minute you layer into that a reflective process, like talking about it, or journaling about it, or painting or drawing about it, all of a sudden you have an experience that's starting to integrate the three parts of the brain. And this is where I start talking about where I truly think craniosacral therapy is a good modality for this kind of stuff. Because, I mean, and I'm a psychotherapist. I love talk therapy. I think talk therapy is amazing. And it's verbally driven, so it tends to be top-down. It tends to be cognitive. It tends to be neocortex and then work its way into the emotion and into the R complex. Whereas touch has the ability to meet all three parts of the brain at once, or has a way to go directly to the R complex and the M complex. And I am particular, and this is any kind of touch, but I'm particularly a fan of craniosacral touch because it's gentle and we're not putting a lot of stimulus into the body. So any kind of touch that has like movement or stimulus, basically the content of the work is coming from the practitioner and is moving things around the body. Whereas really integrating the brain needs to come more from the person outward. You want the content of the work to come from the inner world of the person, not from the external. And so that blending and melding touch that we have in craniosacral therapy, where we're not moving rapidly and not putting a lot of tension into the tissue, we're just inviting awareness. And so my belief is that the gentle, safe touch of craniosacral therapy is able to provide that perfect experience that turns into an integration of the three parts of the brain. Okay, so that's one conclusion, the power of touch. Conclusion number two, I want to remind you that all of the oral structures are hardwired into the R complex through the trigeminal nerve. And we see that regularly. If we push any of you into a corner hard enough, you're gonna start biting whoever's nearby in order to keep yourself safe. These are important structures for your very survival. And so what that means, and here's another value of the mouth work is highly indicated for any kind of stress presentation, anxiety presentation, or trauma presentation because it's direct access to the R complex. So a lot of you discovered today that receiving the mouth work was actually surprisingly relaxing. There is a reason for that, because allowing these structures to soften and open up is helping with downregulation of the R complex, which is why it's so critical for trauma work. Conclusion number three, blending and melding. You know, so far in the curriculum, when we talk about blending and melding, we've mainly been talking about how we touch, where we want our hands to become part of somebody else's tissues. This now invites a broader understanding of blending and melding, of kind of how I interact with another person, how I attune to another person, how I interact with another person. And so part of that is, like, you know, people have proclivities. Some of your clients are primarily neocortical, some of your clients are primarily mammalian, and some of your clients are primarily reptilian. Your neocortical clients are the ones that want to know how much research has been done on craniosacral therapy before they get on the table. They want to know exactly how many arachnoid granulations are in the third ventricle before they get work done. You know, and if you have a neocortical client, you kind of have to meet them there. You talk about available research, you talk about the nature of the work, you go a little bit more technical, help them poke at it until they're like, oh, okay, and then they're willing to lay down for you. You don't pull out a guitar and start singing Kumbaya at that moment. No, you meet them kind of at that neocortical level. Likewise, with your M-complex clients, those are the people that feel the world. They feel the world before they make sense of it. And that is particularly relevant for pediatric work, because our neocortex isn't finished developing until about the age of 25. When I learned that, that gave me a lot of compassion on college kids, and I gleefully remind my 21-year-old daughter that her brain isn't done yet. To which she gleefully reminds me that after the age of 25, it's all decline. And so really working with kids, it's about meeting them in their affective emotional experience. It's not about reasoning with them. It's not about explaining things. It's like, all right, you know, let's play with this for a while. Or let's just chit chat and get comfortable. And so working with kids really requires you being able to be in the M complex yourself. And then our R complex clients, those can be challenging. Those are the people that filter the entire world into safety before experiencing it in any other way. And R complex clients are challenging because sometimes they can be coming to you for quite a while with very little apparent change. And you're wondering why they keep coming back. And it may be that they're nervous system is just trying to make sense out of the fact that you're not going to attack them. And only after their nervous system is thoroughly satisfied that you're not going to attack them, only then can they begin feeling the feelings and the thoughts associated with it. So from a blending and melding point of view, and I love this, rather than just touch, it becomes more a process of meeting a person where they're at, and then adding 5 grams of influence into other parts of themselves. So with the neocortical, it's meeting them neocortically and then offering 5 grams of influence into their affective emotional experience. For a mammalian client, this meeting them emotionally and then maybe offering 5 grams into their reflective experience of it. And for our complex clients, well, it's meeting them at that safety level for sometimes a very long time, and then inviting movement into that emotional and into that cognitive portions of it. All right, so let's see. The conclusions. Part of the mouth work, part of the child work, integrative experiences of the brain, blending and melding.